It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we find out what new independent films will be featured on Wisconsin Public Television's new season of Director's Cut.
First, a new memo from Attorney General Jeff Sessions will undo the criminal charging policies of the Obama era. The memo directs federal prosecutors to be as tough as possible on defendants in criminal cases. It tells them to, quote, pursue the most serious, readily provable offense.
Sessions said the new policies will create, quote, just and consistent results, but critics say it'll lead to more incarceration, especially for lower-level offenses.
Joining us now to tell us more is Kalila Brown-Dean. She's an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, who has written about the criminal justice system. Kalila, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you run through the changes being called for in this memo from Attorney General Jeff Sessions?
So quickly, the memo reverses many of the provisions put in place by Eric Holder. It gives prosecutors a very narrow definition of who should be charged with these crimes. So it doesn't matter if you weren't involved in a gang or in a drug cartel. It does not matter how much of a particular drug that you've been caught with or charged with trafficking. It will trigger those prosecutors to pursue very long sentences with very little leeway in doing that. So it will reintroduce what we call mandatory minimums. Regardless of your individual circumstance, if you are running afoul of these laws, it will be a long punishment.
And looking back at where we came from, what was the thinking behind some of those Holder directives?
So I think what Attorney General Holder realized at the time was we had these very stiff policies, but they were unintended consequences. So we saw prison populations booming. It became very ineffective. It was extremely costly. And taxpayers said enough. If we talk about big government and government bloat, the massive size of the criminal justice system was an exemplar. And what it also meant was that people were serving very long sentences and coming out with no way to effectively contribute to society. So it's creating bigger problems for law-abiding citizens.
So how closely does this memo and what it says, how closely does that align with those older mandates back from the war on drugs days?
It is a sharp return to the law and order era, actually, of Richard Nixon, which set in motion the war on drugs effort during the Reagan administration and also expanded during Bill Clinton's term. So it is a way of saying we will not tolerate this behavior. We're going to have a very hardline approach to this. But what the memo does not recognize are the political and economic questions that will also be front and center once we return to this way.
And what are those?
So it's extremely costly to have inmates in a federal prison system. And it also means that the more people you have going into those prisons, you need to accommodate them. So what happened shortly after the election, within days, is that stocks in private prisons soared. And Jeff Sessions has already undone other memos that said the federal government would not use private prisons. So now you have massive corporations that will benefit economically from this policy change. How we maintain that, how we sustain it, will create problems for states and localities, not just the federal government.
Now, as I understand it, the rationale behind some of this tough-on-crime policy is that the tougher the sentence, the more people will be deterred from committing that crime. And Jeff Sessions has says, for example, he says the murder rate is up, and that's a sign the current policy isn't working. So is there a case to be made that, given where we are right now, it's time to go back to a policy like this?
So I think what's missing from the Sessions memo is the data and the sort of hard reality that the homicide rate is actually half of what it was, not just 20 years ago, but even 10 years ago. Crime rates are down across the board. Inmate populations are down across the board. And much of that violence that he's mentioning is not drug-related. It's actually domestic, increases in domestic violence resulting in death, as well as mass casualty events. So it sounds good in theory to say we're going to make our community safer, but it doesn't really target the root of the problem.
We're talking right now with Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and we're looking at the impact of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' memo directing federal prosecutors to charge defendants with the toughest possible penalties. And Lila, is this going to affect more than drug offenders? Will it affect other other people in the system, for instance?
It will have some ripple effects. So once you open up the possibility that prosecutors can be more hardline on drug offenses, then it also opens the door to say, well, what about other things? So it could be white-collar crimes like fraud. It could be more pedestrian crimes that we think about that aren't necessarily drug-related here. But the ways in which drugs become the wedge issue is if you look at states that have legalized marijuana, either recreationally or medical marijuana, anyone who is seen as aiding and abetting those industries in an indirect or direct way will also be affected by these changes.
And at the same time, we're seeing a cultural push in some areas, looking at Colorado, for instance, where recreational marijuana is legal. Are we going to see some clashes set up now?
You know, Sessions has made it clear that anyone who uses marijuana for any reason has a morally deficient belief system. And he's made that clear from the time that he was first floated as a possible nominee to now his term as Attorney General. So looking forward, we should expect some crackdowns from the DEA, the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency, so that even if your local area or your state has allowed for medical marijuana or for recreational, it's still illegal at the federal level. And at the discretion of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, they can go in, they can have raids, they can arrest people. And again, it's our local jurisdictions that will have to foot that bill.
Well, looking, for instance, at Wisconsin, which is experiencing an opioid epidemic, we have Republican lawmakers in the state who have introduced more treatment-oriented legislation for opioid addicts and some of the crimes that could be associated with that. What do you see happening there, where there's one approach taken by the state and seemingly another by the federal government?
It has created a conflict that is not just a legal conflict, but it is also a practical conflict. So that when we hear from law enforcement officers who say, this epidemic is growing in ways that we cannot keep up with, and that if we don't have these interventions where people feel like if they're in trouble, they can go to law enforcement or they can go to local officials, it's going to compound the problem even more. And so, you know, we can talk about drugs. Drugs are bad. Certainly no one wants that in their community. But if we don't address the depths of addiction and how it is ensnaring communities beyond those traditionally targeted by some of these drug laws, it's going to create a crisis in our cities, in our states, and ones that state legislators across the political spectrum are saying, this is not a partisan issue. This is a basic human rights issue for us to address. How are we actually going to move forward and eradicate this problem?
Now, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has also said that this change in policy will untie the hands of prosecutors, and it will also stop the federal government from interfering so much in how a case is prosecuted. Is this something that could be seen as being welcomed by some of these prosecutors across the country?
I think it will vary based on where those prosecutors are and also what their particular political affiliation is. Many prosecutors across the U.S., we're not just talking about federal prosecutors, but lower prosecutors are elected officials. And so in those key election years, what the federal government is doing, what U.S. attorneys across the country, what they're directed to do becomes a signal and a marker for those other prosecutors as well. So I think some will be happy that they won't feel as hamstrung by some of these previous memos, but they also understand the collateral consequences of what happens when we lock up more people for longer periods of time. What's the impact on their children that get left behind? What's the impact on family and community when you're removing human capital and never really having effective ways for people to return back to their community?
And Kalila, as we wrap up, we're at a point in time now when there has been growing interest in prison reform. We're looking at overcrowding issues, at what's the most effective way to deter recidivism, for instance. Where does this leave those bigger issues of prison reform?
Well, I think it becomes a major obstacle to that reform. Over the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen a growing bipartisan consensus of people across the political spectrum saying, what we are doing is simply not working. And if it were working, we wouldn't have this opioid crisis that's devastating rural communities as well as urban communities. So it's going to be a time for people to reach across the aisle to say, what's the goal and how do we get there? And we should expect some lawsuits once this memo goes into effect of people arguing that it is a violation of civil liberties and that it does not push us toward actually addressing the issue.
Kalila, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. She was with us there to take a look at the impact of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' memo directing federal prosecutors to charge defendants with the toughest penalties.
Right now, Wisconsin Public Television kicks off its 10th season of Director's Cut this evening. The program features independent films that have a connection to Wisconsin.
Pete Schwab is with us to give us a preview of the films that are going to be showing this year. He's the host of Director's Cut, as well as an actor, director, and stand-up comedian. Pete, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
So we live in this era right now where we have films all over the place. We can watch it on Netflix, premium movie channels, old-fashioned movie theaters. So why do you think it's important that a show like Director's Cut about Wisconsin exists?
I'll tell you why. And first of all, I just want to say that, yes, this is our 10th season, so we've officially outlasted Cheers and Seinfeld.
Wow.
When it comes to the amount of seasons, if I can pat us on the back for a minute. But
congrats, yeah.
Look out, Simpsons.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's we got a long way to go there, but I think it's important because a lot of our films do have a connection to Wisconsin, and frankly, a lot of them are on such a small budget, in many cases, where you won't even have a chance to see them in theaters or on TV or even on Netflix. And it's to the point where the market has so many movies, all those outlets are flooded. So, and you'll see films like on Director's Cut that are only an hour long that won't have a chance to broadcast on other networks. And also the local angle definitely helps.
Yeah, talk about the kind of connections with Wisconsin that we've seen on films over the years on Director's Cut.
Well, it really varies. I mean, we have films that were shot in Wisconsin that kind of showcase Wisconsin. We had a film shot in Baraboo a few years ago called Into the Wake. Just had beautiful, stunning photography of that area. We have directors that didn't film film in Wisconsin but are from here. It really varies. It's kind of interesting because it's not limiting either. Like, we have a couple films this year, I think, that have no connection to Wisconsin, but whenever we can, we try to find that connection,
So Director's Cut, you said, has been around going on 10 years now. What's changed about the film industry in Wisconsin? Is it picking up?
I wish I could say it is. There's an excellent community of filmmakers in Wisconsin. There's a great community in Madison, in Milwaukee, and even up north. I think how it's changed is that for a while, the filmmaking incentives were being considered here. They're not now. So I think a show like Director's Cut, which is so unique, and you don't associate a state like Wisconsin with having this kind of cool show about indie filmmaking, I think we should have incentives here. I think we do need to draw more businesses to Wisconsin to shoot films because it's good for an economy, it's good for the arts and culture, and you've got a show like Director's Cut to help you promote them.
And Pete, tell us a little more about the format of the show. You don't just press play and we watch the movie.
Right. Well, Director's Cut is typically it's 25 to 30 minutes long. I interview the director of the film, of a certain film, and then after the interview, during the interview, we kind of intersperse it with clips from the film. I talk to the director about their process, the movie, experiences they had filming the film. And then Director's Cut Presents plays the film in its entirety right after the interview.
And let's dig a little bit into the season. We've got one coming up called The Bear and the Owl. And this is a clip from that first film that's going to be aired. And it's a documentary about a young girl with a rare illness and a stranger who becomes her pen pal. Here's a listen.
It wasn't a typical card that you'd normally see in the mail with just typical address on it. It would have like a bird on it or a bear or something, or the bear would be made out of like a thumbprint. And then all of a sudden after the first one, second one, I thought, wow, what's going on here? And then I found out that she was really sick and stuff. And then the cards just kept coming and coming and stuff. So, it was a highlight of my day kind of to see the cards.
Tell us a little more, Pete, about The Bear and the Owl. That premieres, that's in the premiere episode tonight. Tell us a little more about that story.
Yeah, that was a film that just kind of blew me away because, like you just heard in the clip, this guy who is a superintendent of schools and a father of three sends this girl he doesn't know a card. And then what he does after that is just stunning. It's a film, you watch the film and when it's over, you're like, man, I have to be a better person. I have to do more. It's a very uplifting and inspirational film. And I don't want to say too much to ruin it, but it's just a really inspiring story.
Can you tell us a little more about the origin of that one or the people behind it?
Well, the people behind it, they're a team, Mark Davis and Jan Jensen. They're a married couple. One of the main characters is Jane's father, and he's the one who used to make these ornate, decadent get-well cards for this young girl. And so we had really good insights into one of our characters, and it was he kind of is the inspiration for the film, as well as the young girl, Joni. And, in fact, I recently hosted a Q&A at the Wisconsin Film Festival after one of these screenings, and they were both there, and it was just a kick.
Well, that one's a documentary. Let's move on to a narrative film now. This is Uncle John. We'll give a listen. This is a thriller about a murder in a small town.
I wanted to come by, though, and give you a heads up.
Heads up?
Yeah. When we had Danny in the squad car, he was going on about how he thinks Dutch has been murdered.
Right.
I don't know. He certainly has himself convinced, but somehow or another, he's naming you on it too, John.
Me? Huh.
Huh. So tell us a little bit about Uncle John, this small town thriller.
That's a great little film. There's something, ever since In the Heat of the Night, I've loved thrillers that take place in small towns. There's like a mysteriousness or... and Uncle John has that. The lead actor, I'm totally blanking on right now, but he's got a fantastic list of credits. Maybe you have it in front of you, but he's a great actor. He was in Midnight Run, Beverly Hills Cop, and he's just a terrific actor. And that's what's so great is when you see these guys that don't have a lot of money, they want to make a film in a small town, and you have these great actors that are willing to go. I lived through that. I made my own film and got people to come to my hometown in Wisconsin to make a movie. It's such a thrill. And then when you see them execute it, this movie is it's a narrative, which is kind of my background are narrative films. And it's great to see a narrative movie made for such a low budget and to see guys really pull it off. That's going to be a great one, too.
Do you think there's something about Wisconsin that does lend itself almost to the, Wisconsin gothic sort of sensibility like you might see in Twin Peaks or Fargo?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've had enough kind of strange characters come from the state that lends itself to that. But I think there's something creepy about small towns in general if you kind of let your imagination wander. And certainly Uncle John has those. And the actor's name is John Ashton. He's a really good actor, and he does a great job. And there is a character actor in that film who's actually in Fargo, too. So it's funny you mentioned Fargo.
We're talking to Pete Schwabe. He's the host of Wisconsin Public Television's Director's Cut. It debuts its 10th season tonight with another series of films, mostly with a connection to Wisconsin. Back to documentaries now. This is another one on the schedule. Scout's Honor, Inside a Marching Brotherhood. Here's a clip.
Drum Corps is basically, as I describe it to people, it's like professional marching band. It's a marching band show, just like a high school marching band competes. You know, we go and we compete and we learn a show. The difference is we spend 2.5 months on the road doing it every single day, whereas a quote-unquote normal marching band, you know, do a couple, three rehearsals a week. And so we get things to a much, much, much higher level than a high school or a college could.
Clip there from Scout's Honor, Inside a Marching Brotherhood. And it's one of those areas, I think, Pete, where you think you don't expect there to be such intensity behind the story of this kind of like a marching band.
Well, I didn't expect there to be the intensity. I didn't even know this kind of subculture existed. And that's one of the things I love about documentary films. Like the things you learn or take away from them. These are guys high school, college age, but it's not a high school band. It's not a college band. It's competitive marching. And they pay money to be part of it, and they really just throw their hearts into it. And it's another one that's really inspiring. And it's when the director was on the show, he kept talking about a brotherhood, And you definitely see that that exists there. And it's just one of those things that, like I said, I didn't know this world existed. So it's fun to kind of go into that world.
Is this a world you'd watching this want to be part of, or does it look too intense? I was in marching band, but I understand drum corps is a whole other level.
That's true. It's true. Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, look, I taught myself to play the guitar, so I feel bad for anybody who has to listen to me. So I'm probably not the guy to ask that question.
So, Pete, what else are you looking forward to coming up this season?
Well, we've got another film called Alley Cat, which is great, another narrative about competitive bike racing in Chicago at night. That was kind of and you talk about creepy small towns, this is through the streets of Chicago, and there a lot of them are desolate. There's some really good photography in that film. Another great film called From Mass to the Mountain, about a priest from Ripon, Wisconsin, who has been in Panama for almost 30 years and kind of is single-handedly building infrastructure in a region of Panama so that people have drinking water and a more livable community. Very inspiring. And then another documentary called Deep Time about the oil boom in North Dakota. So, yeah, just great films. Every year I'm kind of blown away with what the producers put in front of me, because they're all just really good films.
And Pete, remind us, when can we watch this?
Our first episode is tonight at 10 o'clock Wisconsin time.
And will this be on Milwaukee Public Television?
Yeah, this year we're on in Milwaukee, which is great because, as I mentioned before, we have, you know, there's such a great film community in Milwaukee, and we've had so many guests on from Milwaukee, but we can't, you know, they can't tell their friends they're on this show. And this season, I'm not sure what the air date will be, but we'll be on in Milwaukee. And I actually host a show on WTMJ now on Saturday afternoon, so I can kind of help promote it and build the film community a little bit there, too, because Wisconsin has, like I said, just a phenomenal group of filmmakers, and I'd love to see more of it happen here.
Pete, sounds like a great season. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, guys. A lot of fun.
That's Pete Schwabe, host of Wisconsin Public Television's Director's Cut program. The 10th season of that program premieres tonight on Wisconsin Public Television. It's Food Friday. Dill, chives, and other fresh herbs are starting to pop up in gardens around the state, and it's almost warm enough to plant a whole bunch of great flavors.
Our guest has advice on how to use those herbs in entrees, desserts, and beverages, and even in crafts and beauty products.
Jim Rood and Jenna Carlin are with us now. They're based in Wisconsin, and they blog at Little Rusted Ladle. Their new cookbook is called Herbs for Flavor, Health, and Natural Beauty. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Jenna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
So, Jim, I get the impression, looking at this book, that you really, really like herbs. Why did you tackle them in your new book?
Well, what's not to love about herbs? I mean, they're loaded with flavor and healthy benefits, and they're beautiful. And my mom has instilled the bug in me when I was little. So,
and
why
Jenna.
Not, right?
Jenna, you use herbs for more than just food. What kinds of other stuff do you like to do with herbs?
I like to use them in home decor projects and also home beauty projects, like lip gloss and soaps, wreaths, and potpourri, that sort of thing.
And so if you've got a wreath made out of herbs, Jenna, it's what? I guess you're smelling that for a long time then.
Oh, yeah. They're great fresh, and then even when they dry, you can still hang them up and throw a little essential oils on them, keep them smelling great all year round.
And you talk about, Jim, how the thing that's lovely about herbs is that you don't just, you know, it's not like plucking a lemon, you eat it, you're done. With herbs, you pluck some more grows. They just keep giving to you all season long.
Correct. I think the misconception about sometimes with herbs is you treat them like fruits or vegetables, and sometimes people are afraid to pick them as if they're going to damage the plant. But in actuality, the herbs love to be cut and cut often. It encourages their growth, and they continue to provide well, you know, every time you cut them. And whereas vegetables and fruits, you know, you kind of wait for weeks or months for them to grow, and then you pick them, and then they're done. So herbs are extremely giving, and people just need to understand how versatile and wonderful they are to keep picking them.
And Jenna, you're a photographer, and you have some great pictures of these recipes. We've got a few, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. Do herbs add a lot to the visual appeal of the dishes we're making?
Yes, of course. They add lots of texture, and they photograph beautifully because they're so thin that light can kind of, you can kind of see through them, like kind of, you can, they really pop on an image.
And let's talk a little bit about the book. Now, Jim, you highlight, I think it's 13 different herbs in the book. And for most of them, there is an appetizer, a soup, a salad, a side, and a main dish. Some of them even have a dessert or something to drink. How did that come together, pulling, you know, from the beginning of the meal to the very end using herbs? Was that a stretch or was it pretty easy to do?
Well, for some herbs, it was very easy. And something that I've been using herbs for, you know, in beverages and desserts before. Others, maybe not as easy. It's kind of hard to put chives into a beverage that unless it's maybe a Bloody Mary. But, you know, that kind of came about just because I wanted the cooking element of the book to be to show the versatility of herbs and not just in standard recipes, but kind of push the envelope a little bit and let people see that, wow, you know, I can throw these in an appetizer or a salad. And instead of using, you know, just lettuce, I can throw lemon balm or basil into my salad, and it adds a completely different layer of flavors.
We're talking to Jim Rood and Jenna Carlin. Their new cookbook is Herbs for Flavor, Health, and Natural Beauty. They're both based in Wisconsin, by the way. Well, you mentioned those chives, Jim, and I wanted to get in one of the recipes we have on the Central Time Facebook page. You sent us mini chive blossom cheese balls with chive picks. Talk us through that recipe.
Well, of course, being from Wisconsin, everybody's familiar with the cheese ball. I mean, what's not to love about Wisconsin cheese? And, you know, the various things that go with that. But you're often using normal toothpicks or, you know, you're spooning it off of a big ball. And what's great about the chive, the cheese balls, is that chives, when they produce flowers, they produce a long, kind of stiff stem. That the stem isn't that great eating because it's pretty hard and a little bit kind of woody, or not woody, but, you know, harder than the regular chives. So as a great use for those, if you cut those into small sticks, then you use those as your picks, infusing the center of the cheese ball with more chive flavor and having a more beautiful presentation. Throw it on a slice of apple, and you've got a great little appetizer that's beautiful and showcases the flowers and the blossoms of the chive, which are you know, available either in the spring or in the fall.
Do these come together pretty easily?
The chive blossom mm-hmm. cheese balls? Yeah. Oh, sure. You know, you basically do the same as you would a regular cheese ball. You mix it in the ingredients in a bowl. Form them instead of into one large ball, you'd form them into individual small balls, either using a little scoop or just with your hands, and then just roll them in the chive blossoms and put the pick in it, put it on the slice of apple, and you're good to go.
That's good use of chives. I've got a lot coming up in the yard, so I may give that a try. Jenna, before we move on from the chives, I can't imagine that maybe in a skincare product. I don't know if I want the smell with me that intimately, but do you have crafts you do with chives?
With chives, I didn't do any of those yet. That would be quite a challenge.
Yeah, chive soap. I don't think I want to go there.
Yeah.
I think it could be okay.
Yeah, we haven't done that one yet.
All right, there's a challenge. The gauntlet has been thrown down with chives. Well, an herb that I think that's maybe it's more versatile, I'm going to say basil. I love basil in almost everything. Can't think of anything that I don't like basil in. And that's what's not quite in season yet here in Wisconsin. But tell us about some of the different ways that you use basil.
Well, basil is a fabulous herb. As you know, it's kind of considered the mother of herbs, but because it's kind of a relative of the mint family. So it's it has that kind of sweet, kind of anise-like flavor, and it's used in so many different kind of cultures, whether it's Italian or Thai or, you know, just good old-fashioned American, that it blends itself well in both savory and sweet combinations. So, I mean, can you imagine pesto without basil or, you know, pizza or the regulars are great, but when you toss those nice, fresh, delicate basil leaves with salads, rice, you know, we've got a roasted cauliflower rice with basil that's just really fresh, really healthy, great for you. And, or, you know, even a fettuccine with, you know, the jalapeno pesto, just really showcases the basil really nicely. And don't be afraid to throw it in your desserts. You know, take a standard brownie mix, box of brownie mix, make brownies and, infuse your, you know, your eggs or your milk, your whipped cream with the scent and the flavor of basil, and it takes the dessert to a whole new level.
That would be a surprise to me. And the recipe we've got up on basil on the Central Time Facebook page, berry basil floats. Jenna, what describe the taste of that, because this sounds pretty good on a warm day in Wisconsin.
It is extraordinary. It's one of my favorite recipes in the book. It's got a sherbet flavor, too, with the basil. The vodka we infused with berries and basil as well, and it's so flavorful, and I suggest you all to do it. It's great.
Well, we're talking...
I'm sorry.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
To say that the cookbook, actually, we had to take all the alcohol out of the book, so we don't be afraid to throw it back in with any of the recipes if you see where it might fit.
I see the invite there.
We are from Wisconsin.
Well, we're talking about cooking with fresh herbs on Food Friday right now. And Jenna Carlin and Jim Root are with us. They're based here in Wisconsin. And their new cookbook is called Herbs for Flavor, Health, and Natural Beauty.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite herb for cooking? Do you grow herbs in your garden or your window box? And do you have questions about how to make the most of your basil, chives, rosemary, tarragon, you name it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post and find some great recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Food Friday, and right now we're cooking with herbs. Jenna Carlin and Jim Root are with us, and their new cookbook is called Herbs for Flavor, Health, and Natural Beauty.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you like to cook with fresh herbs? Do you grow basil, chives? Do you have an herb garden at home? What is your favorite one to cook with? Do you have some recipes to suggest? And do you have questions about how to use them? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Jenna, is there a particular herb in the book that you were inspired to work with on the non-food side?
I found mint to be really exciting to work with, just because there's so many varieties of mint. And I used a few of them in the book. But one example is that we use a chocolate mint in the energizing mint and mocha loofah soap.
That sounds pretty great.
That turned out really nice. Just gives a really uplifting scent, especially for in the shower in the morning. They've been great.
Now, I have experience with mint, but not so much with chocolate mint. Does it actually smell, have a fragrance of chocolate?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. It's extremely intense. If you rub the leaves, you'd swear it was bathed in chocolate before, while it was coming up.
That can't be bad.
No. Chocolate and mint, come on.
Now, I hear tell from a well-placed source that dill is starting to come up, right? Michelle Good at the board there. She's got dill coming up at home. Jim, what are some of your favorite things to do with dill?
I'll tell you, when we started doing the book, you know, the standards, it's, you know, great with a seafood salad or with any kind of fish. Fabulous in dips, of course. You can't go to a grocery store without seeing dill and, you know, on potato chips and everything else. But the one that I think really surprised me was just the simplicity of dill with pasta and treating it like a carbonara. With you know, with the cream and the, and of course, you know, you can't go wrong with cream and pasta and butter and dill, but you know, then kind of bringing into that egg with just a soft cooked or a fried egg over the top of it was just, it's wonderful. But just dill in pasta is just amazing. You could just eat buttered noodles and dill, it would be fabulous.
That sounds yummy. Well, let's get a caller in on this. We've got Leon joining us in Watertown. Hi, Leon.
Hi, Leon. Howdy.
What did you want to share with us?
Yeah, so I recently read in a booklet about called Speakeasy Grilled Cheese Sandwich. It embraces a combination of basil and rosemary leaves. And my favorite part of it is you can actually mince your favorite, you know, locally grown fresh herbs, top it up nicely, and you'd also get to caramelize some apricots to create a nice, really, really nice sugar to give you that full flavor, rich flavor, and then you add some maple syrup and also just a tad bit of bourbon glaze. And,
wow.
Oh, it's delicious. It's delicious.
You kept adding
grilled
ingredients.
Cheese, Leon?
What,
you know, you should that was a grilled cheese, right?
Absolutely. I looked it up, and unfortunately, I don't have the recipe on me. It was in a book, I believe, from Madison. It's called The Speakeasy, and I'm sure you can look it up online. Mm. Oh, delicious recipe.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
That's a lot going on in a grilled cheese.
A lot. Yeah, but I bet that basil really makes the apricot sing. We've got an apricot and basil tart in our cookbook, so that's wonderful.
Leon, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Tim on the line in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. Suggestion for basil. I do a wilted basil leaf over like a pan-fried chicken breast. Absolutely delicious. Pan-fried up with some olive oil, a little bit of garlic. And then a suggestion for what to do with dill. Throw it right in the garbage.
No, that's wrong.
Oh, no.
I love dill.
Dill hater. We've got a dill hater.
yeah, it's one of my favorite herbs. Right, it's right up there with basil for me. Basil and dill. Yeah. Is dill a controversial herb?
I don't think so at all. It's not as controversial as cilantro. Cilantro, you either hate it or you love it. But I guess some people don't like dill, but yeah. I don't know.
Well, on the friendlier side, he was all for basil and just use something as simple as, I mean, he said chicken. You can do this with a lot of dishes. Take that one basil leaf, or depending on how big the thing is, a couple basil leaves and just put it on top, and it looks great and adds a lot of flavor. It's a really simple way to use it, isn't it, Jenna?
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds great.
So one herb that I've discovered recently is tarragon, which I think I've gone most of my adult life not quite knowing what it was. And not quite knowing if I liked it. And I discovered recently that I love tarragon. Can you tell us a little bit about how to use it, get the most out of it?
Well, tarragon, it has similar flavor tendencies a little bit to basil, although it's got a little bit more of a kind of a grassy anise flavor, like licorice, basically. So it goes fabulous with seafood. One of the easiest recipes in the book is the grilled lobster tails with tarragon chive butter. Mm. And you just make a compound butter with tarragon. And we have a chive blossom butter in the book that's outstanding. And you just combine the two of those and put it over shrimp or lobster, put it right on the grill. And it just adds an incredible depth of flavor and a little bit of that licorice flavor that just goes great with seafood, but it's great with chicken and a number of pasta dishes. It's a great herb.
We're talking to Jim Rood and Jenna Carlin. Their new cookbook is Herbs for Flavor, Health, and Natural Beauty. We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Doug on the line in Stevens Point. Doug, hi.
Hi. I I wanted to call and say that I can't remember the exact restaurant. There was a restaurant in the Dells that had coleslaw with dill in it, and it was awesome. But I love dill. I mean, I grew up with my mom canning, you know, 100 quarts of pickles every year, and love it.
Doug, thanks a lot for the call. So a dill lover there, and coleslaw. I don't remember if you had coleslaw in the book at all. What kind of herbs, dill or otherwise, would go well in coleslaw? Jenna, let's throw that one at you. Jenna, are you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. What was the question?
What kind of herbs you go well in coleslaw? Our caller was mentioning dill there.
I'm gonna throw that one back at Jim. He's the food guy.
Okay.
Oh yeah, she likes to throw it back in my corner. Well, what's great about herbs is that so many of them go in coleslaw. I mean, dill, parsley, cilantro, basil, tarragon, chives. I think any one of those, as well as I've used thyme, sage. They all have such a different flavor that it just adds a completely different dimension to the coleslaw. So whether it's creamy or a vinaigrette-based,
yeah, coleslaw,
I just go to town.
Coleslaw doesn't seem so hard. What about, and I know you have some of this in your book, what about dessert? What can we add to sweet things? I know we talked about a drink, but what about, like a cake or something that has a little more heft to it? What herbs go well with that?
Well, we've got a tarragon pound cake that I thought had just really nice flavor to it. Again, you've got a little bit of that kind of licorice flavor that, herbs do really well in kind of a fat environment, where there's some fat into it, whether it's, a butter cake, a pound cake, or, a creamy sauce, because those oils of the herbs just have a way of being able to infuse themselves into the whole dish. But, with desserts, it doesn't have to be a decadent type thing. You could have fruit for a dessert. You could have, apples, just simple apple salad or a melon blackberry salad that's used as a dessert. That herbs go wonderful. Thyme, mint, of course, is going to go great as a dessert item, but you're only limited by your own imagination when it comes to herbs.
Just as we wrap up, Jenna, we've spent more time on the food, but getting back to the crafts or body care products, what is your next project? What seasonal herb is coming up that you're looking at crafting with?
I should be seeing some lavender here pretty quick. I have a whole row of it at my house, and looking forward to putting that into some more wreaths and making some swags.
And Jim, lavender, I believe it's a scent and not a flavor. Do you cook with lavender?
I do cook with lavender, and lavender is definitely one of those herbs that's great in desserts as well. Goes great in a angel food cake, cookies. But you find restaurants, a lot of restaurants now are using it in savory dishes, putting it in risotto, or using it to flavor fish and different things. So lavender was one of those ones we debated on, and we just ran out of time. We could have put another half a dozen herbs in the book if we had more time. So
you can go into the sequel. Thanks for all the great inspiration. That was Jim Rood and Jenna Carlin. They blog at Little Rusted Ladle. Their new cookbook is Herbs for Flavor, Health, and Natural Beauty. Find recipes at the Central Time Facebook page.
Avocados are a hot commodity lately, but with that popularity comes a price, the dreaded avocado hand.
According to reporting in the Times of London and the New York Times, some plastic and reconstructive surgeons are seeing more patients who have cut their hands while slicing into an avocado.
The problem, I guess, people cup the avocado in one hand and then cut it with the other. And I guess, you know, you get those super ripe, buttery avocados and you got a really sharp knife and you do the math. Your knife is slicing a little farther than you intended.
Right. I had pictured it wrong at first. You cleared it up for me. You've got the pit out and then you want to slice it up or cube it up. And that's when people are holding it in their hand and doing it. And yeah, a hard, less ripe avocado, probably no problem.
So
but
if you're
some
like
really soft, squishy ones,
you're like our family and you prefer your knives really dull, almost like butter knives or spoons, then you don't have this problem.
Right. I have not. I have cut myself while cutting things. I don't think I've ever gotten myself with an avocado. And I think I don't do it the wrong way. I actually put it on the cutting board and slice it. So I'm not putting myself at risk of bodily harm.
Yeah. Avocado hand, the close cousin of bagel hand.
Well, remember in the kitchen, safety first. This is Central Time. Now cuts like a knife.